Good afternoon, and welcome to On the Docket. I'm Patricia Salkin, Dean of Toro Law Center in Central Islip. Every Sunday at this time, we'll talk about current legal issues and how they affect you. Today, on the docket, we're talking about the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, commonly called the Affordable Care Act, or ACA, or Obamacare. After getting off to a bumpy start, the Affordable Care Act open enrollment period closed on March 31st, with more than 7 million enrollees. Although there still remain many questions about exactly what the new exchanges and policies mean for average Americans and businesses. Today, we're fortunate to have two guests, Ed Dower and Adam Rosenfeld, on the show to help us better understand how the ACA will impact your family and business. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. First, we'll start with Ed Dower. Ed is a distinguished visiting professor in health law and policy at Toro Law Center. Previously, Ed was dean and professor of law at the University of Denver in Denver, Colorado. Additionally, Ed served for over a decade as a visiting scholar at the Program on Healthcare Negotiation and Conflict Resolution at the Harvard School of Public Health, and he has published two books in the field of healthcare alternative dispute resolution. Thanks for being on the show today, Ed.
Thank you, Dean. I'm very glad to be here.
Ed, you have a wide breadth of experience in health policy. Can you just explain to us what the Affordable Care Act actually does?
I think of the Act as having three sets of objectives that have been implemented in three waves or phases. The first phase, which was at the beginning, included reforms of insurance laws. Federal laws change the way that health insurers do business with the people whom they insure. Some examples used to be before the ACA that insurers could turn you down if you had a pre-existing condition. They can't do that anymore. They could deny you coverage if you became ill after you've been covered for a while. That can't be done anymore. They could put caps on the lifetime amounts that you could have from your health insurance if you became ill frequently or became ill chronically, and that can't be done anymore. So that's the first phase, some of these reforms in the way the insurance business is run. And so far as I can tell, that phase is working out really very well. Phase two, Dean, is the one that you just mentioned, and that's where we are right now. The second objective of the Act was to extend health insurance to as many of the 30 million people as possible who didn't have health insurance before the Act went into effect. The parts of the law that do that include changes to Medicaid, the creation of the state exchanges where people can sign up to get coverage and where they can get subsidies depending on their income. And all the rules that require employers to provide coverage for their employees. This part of it also included the individual mandate, which is really the only requirement individuals have, and that is they need to be participating in some fashion in the insurance market and to be covered lest they have to pay some penalties in their taxes if they don't do so. That seems to be going pretty well. As you mentioned, there are 7 or 8 million who've signed up nationally, and in New York, the ratio looks pretty good. I understand there are about 900,000 of the 1.1 million whom they expected. That's the second phase, and that seems to be underway. The third phase is what we'll see unfold over the next couple of years. It includes efforts to try to control total healthcare spending and to achieve cost efficiencies as well as quality improvements, in a word, to enhance the value of what healthcare does and to improve what it is we get for what we spend on it.
Right. So all of this has an impact, of course, on the marketplace and on insurance. And so from the insurance company's perspective, what do you think the law's impact actually is panning out to be on the cost of insurance and the quality of insurance?
From the insurance company's perspective, there are a couple of things that they need to observe. They're required now under the Act to spend at least a certain minimum amount of their premium revenues on actual direct care. That minimum is either 80 or 85%, depending on which part of the market they're in. Insurance companies also care about quality, and quality and value are the things that this third phase of the law is focusing on most. I can offer a couple of examples, if I may, of what's in the ACA on cost and quality. Just two. One of them is over $1 billion of investments in something called comparative effectiveness research. Right now, for most diseases or conditions, there are multiple therapies a physician and a patient can choose from. And although individual drugs are subjected to rigorous testing through the FDA before they're marketed, we don't have a lot of really good information about comparisons of costs and effectiveness of one drug or one treatment method as opposed to another. And as a result of that, there is probably some waste in the system that can be removed and to make it more cost-effective. So the idea is to develop that kind of information to make it available to patients and providers so they can make better decisions about both effectiveness and cost. And, of course, that comes to the benefit of the insurers as well, because ultimately they're the ones who sign the checks, and so the reduction of waste is advantageous all the way around for providers, for patients, and insurers. Another example that affects everybody is our changes in the way in which providers, physicians and hospitals and others get paid. One example of that is something called gain sharing. Before the ACA, providers used to make more money if they provided more service, regardless of the outcome for the patient. What's called gain sharing and some other new models are trying to turn that around, and that is to pay providers for the episode of care rather than just for each of its components, to say there will be this many dollars for this kind of treatment regardless of what it actually costs, which will try to make the providers more efficient. And then to add to the payments, particularly under Medicare, the payments that providers receive, increments or premiums if they provide that care with measured ways of improving and enhancing the quality of it. So that's the third phase, and we'll see how that unrolls. We don't know much about that yet. It'll take a couple of years before we begin to see the results.
Right. So on your on the first phase of looking at the comparative effectiveness research, if the insurance companies are doing that, they're actually disclosing information to the physicians and the patients that impacts on the pharmaceutical industry as well.
Well, one would hope that. The control of this effectiveness research, under the Act at least, will be initially with the federal government agency, which will be doing it across the board, though it's exceedingly likely that what will happen is it will be distributed to providers and insurers everywhere through contracts and other ways of gathering that data from everybody.
Right. So I want to go down another path. We've seen a lot of concern among religious employers and hospitals about certain provisions with the law pertaining to abortion. What are some of the other potential legal issues you see with regard to successful implementation or enforcement of the Affordable Care Act?
You know, it's hard to predict what parts of the Act are going to be troublesome for somebody because it's so complex and it's causing such changes that there's the inevitable jostling for position that will cause some kinds of disputes to arise. I don't expect any additional major challenges to the foundations of the Act itself. I may be wrong, but that's how I see it. I think we're probably past that. As I see it, I would predict that the action is going to move from the courts to the legislatures because there are a couple of things which the ACA will make more insistent that the ACA, as it now stands, did not cover. Again, if I can just offer a couple of examples very quickly.
Sure.
One of them has to do with what we call scope of practice laws. These are the laws which say what kinds of things physicians have to do, what kinds of things physicians' assistants can do, the sorts of things nurses can do, and so on. If we add anywhere near 30 million more people, we're going to have a very significant increase in the demand for primary care. That's the first line of activity by the medical profession. And we already have a shortage of primary care physicians. So what that means is that if the Act is successful in bringing into the fold of the insured and those who have health care available to them, if it's successful in bringing in any large numbers of those, the pressure on the workforce is going to increase. And so what I see already is indications of legislatures and other people in the policy arena thinking about whether those scope of practice laws need to be changed. I think that's one place we will see some legal activity, though not in the courts, but more in the legislatures. Another, and the other one, is malpractice, which President Obama told the American Medical Association he would attend to, but which Congress didn't put into the ACA, and it's a piece of unfinished business. It's politically very difficult to find agreement on it, but the reason why it may become more insistent, I can illustrate with one example. The Act creates new entities called accountable care organizations, which will bring doctors together with so-called mid-level people, with hospitals, and put them into very highly integrated systems. So it may be that medical malpractice will have to change from a focus on the activity of individual doctors to a focus on the activity of these integrated systems.
Right.
And to have a, if, to the extent that malpractice liability is designed to help make healthcare safer, then having that systems view is something we may see the interest in that kind of change in malpractice occurring. Those are the two that I see coming up within the next couple of years.
Yeah, clearly there still is a lot to work out. The Affordable Care Act is a work in progress. I want to thank you, Ed, for sharing those wonderful insights with us. And please stay with us, because coming up, we'll talk to Adam Rosenfeld on the impact of healthcare reform on businesses. Welcome back to On the Docket. I'm here with Ed Dower, and we're talking about the Affordable Care Act. We are thrilled to also have Adam Rosenfeld on the show today. Welcome, Adam.
Thanks. Good to be back.
Adam is president of BT Benefits and Consulting, operating out of the New York regional offices of Baker Tilly Virchow Krause. And Adam is also, get this, a certified Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act professional by the National Association of Health Underwriters. And maybe we could talk about what it takes to get to that. But Adam has over 25 years' experience. He helps employers, both large and small, manage the complex world of employee benefits. So, Adam, we just heard Ed speak about the Affordable Care Act structure and some of its legal implications for individuals. From an employer's standpoint, there's a lot of misinformation out there. So let me ask you, what's really required of them? Do all employers need to offer coverage? And what happens if they don't? It's a lot of questions.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're exactly right, Patty. There's a lot of misinformation out there. And what's also bad, if you just read and skim the headlines of stories but don't read the whole story, you don't get the full picture. So, for example, earlier this year, the IRS published final regulations on the employer shared responsibility rules, also known as the pay or play penalties. So one of the things said in the headlines was that employers of size 50 to 99 employees had yet another year delay before facing the penalties. But the full story is that these medium-sized employers, as they're now called, must meet certain criteria and must request that extra year delay. It's not automatic. So it sure can be misleading. But let me back up and answer your question directly. No, not all employers are required to offer coverage. Small employers and those with less than 50 full-time or full-time equivalent employees are not required to offer coverage. Large employers, those with 50 or more full-time or full-time equivalent employees, are required to offer coverage or possibly face a penalty. And the final regulations that we just mentioned is that medium-sized employers, 50 to 99, have a delay of a year. So the next question is, are you small, medium, or a large group? So the answer is not as simple as the question, because the government counts employees, full-time employees, as 30 hours or more, and then adds back in employees that are part-time with a calculation called full-time equivalence. So a simple example would be two 15-hour-a-week people, you add them together, that's 30 hours, that equals one full-time equivalent employee. There's also some rules for seasonal workers as well. Plus, to add more to that, commonly owned businesses are added together for purposes of determining what size group you are. So all this counting needs to be done and traced monthly, because if there is a penalty, ultimately it's levied on a monthly prorated basis. So it's certainly not a simple task. Let's see. You also ask what happens if you don't offer coverage. So once the law is in full effect, you are subject to a penalty of $2,000 per full-time employee per year minus the first 30 employees.
That's only if you have 50 or more employees.
50 or more, correct.
So where do people go to get, where do business owners go to get this kind of information? Are there insurance companies providing it? Are there accounting firms providing it? Who's educating the business owner?
Well, I am, for one. At BT Benefits Consulting, we are an insurance brokerage. Mm. And the role of brokers, and that's tied to what you said in the opening, of it, we're all part of the National Association of Health Underwriters.
Right.
Our role has greatly changed from being almost an order taker and a problem solver on a reactive basis to becoming much more of a proactive compliance assistance and really truly a business partner with our clients.
Right. So I know that the Internal Revenue Service issued final rules on larger employer reporting requirements last month. Can you tell us when businesses need to actually start reporting on this?
Sure. Well, as you said, the final regs were issued in March, and they apply to calendar years, not plan years, but calendar years that start after December 31st, 2014. So we're reporting on the calendar year of 2015. Mm-hmm. Now, there's two types of reporting required, one that the employer does to the IRS, kind of an informational return, and one that's done to the employees, which is most similar to when you give them a W-2 at the end of each year. The form that they're using, they're tentatively calling it a 1095. So the IRS returns are due on the employer side. They're due annually at the end of February or March if you're e-filing. So the earliest IRS deadline is actually March 1st, 2016, reporting on the year 2015. The employee statements are also due annually, but they're due on January 31st of each year. So January of 2016, I think that's a Sunday, so it's actually February 1st of 2016. The reports will contain information like whether the employer offered coverage for that year and how many months in that year, whether the employee was enrolled, and again, how many months if it wasn't for the full year, if the plan is deemed affordable by the definition of ACA, and if it meets minimum value, which actually brings up an important point I wanted to mention. Is how does an employer stay penalty-free? And the key here is to design a plan that meets the ACA definition of affordable and is also of minimum value. If you do those things, you won't be assessed a penalty.
So we've been talking about employers that have 50 or more employees, but lots of businesses on Long Island are small businesses that have far less than 50 employees. Do you do work with those companies and counseling them and their employees about the exchange?
Yeah, we do. And the most common question, in fact, I got one this morning from a new client who said, you know, what if I just throw in the towel and I don't participate at all and I just give my employees a raise and send them to the exchange? And that is a viable option. Mm-hmm. I should say it's an option. How viable it is kind of depends on each individual business's circumstances. Because the first thing that comes to mind is, well, why do you offer insurance now? There's no rule that requires you offer insurance today, or at least before ACA. So most employers did it, starting after World War II, they did it to attract and retain talent.
Correct.
So, and in fact, that particular business owner that said that to me also mentioned to me that his whole warehouse, all his people in the warehouse had been there since, he took over the business from his father. So they had been there almost his whole lifetime.
Right.
So they're very loyal.
Well, and so if it was because there was no exchange and it was way more expensive for individuals to try to get insurance coverage without an employer, and now with the exchange, it's really not about talent recruitment for these small employers anymore.
Well, I mean, if you look at how complex the buying process is. Mm-hmm. And I sit with business owners and CFOs, and it's complicated, and their response is always, oh my God, how do you do this on a day-to-day basis? And these are people that are running a business.
Right.
If you were to take that buying decision to every single person, it gets pretty complicated. It's overwhelming right now, which is why the enrollment was as lagged as it was. I mean, the numbers kind of surged at the end, but they're certainly lagged behind what they were originally thinking.
Right. So do you know what the plans are? I think that Ed mentioned we had about 7 million enrolled. There are 30 million who are eligible for it. What's happening to the other 20 plus million people?
Well, one of the things that came out, actually read in the papers this morning, was that employer plan enrollment is actually up as well.
Mm-hmm.
The net figures, I forget the percentages, but I think it was something like 14 million up. It was a net number. Maybe it was 5 million, 14 was the gross, and then the net was 5 million up. So in other words, more employers are offering coverage, so people are actually having more of a choice to get there as well. Getting through the exchange, there's different products and different networks available. And in the New York market, there are less network choices. And there's also no option for out-of-state coverage. So if you travel or you have family that's, perhaps you have kids that live in another state, they don't have in-network benefits elsewhere. They have emergency coverage only. Whereas on the group plan, for instance, if you're on like an Oxford plan or an Aetna, you have national network in-network coverage.
Right. So of course, there are benefits to staying on the traditional plans if your employer is willing to keep that going. However, a lot of the small businesses find that as everybody is crunched with costs, that they may not feel so bad because there's a viable alternative for their employees.
Right. And I can tell you, out of the hundreds of clients we have, many of them being under 50, out of all those, many of them went through that thought process, and at the end of the day, one went to the exchange.
Wow.
They went through their processes. They talked to their employees. And in fact, I had a few others that said they were going to do it. And then when they went out and talked to their employees, they came back and said, the employees basically said, please, we want to keep our current plan. We don't want to do it on our own.
Right. So lots of complex thought processes to go through, lots of detailed minutiae on what is and isn't covered and how the potential plans that you would have an option for in the exchange differ from the plan that your employer currently offers, which, of course, those plans also change on a regular basis, at least annually when they come up for renewal.
Right. And they all change this year, January 1st, or your first renewal thereafter, to be healthcare reform compliant.
Right.
They all needed to change. So there's turmoil everywhere.
Okay. So you've convinced me. I understand now why we need certified patient protection and Affordable Care Act professionals.
Yeah.
I want to thank both Ed and Adam. It was a pleasure to have you both on the show today. And thank you out there for listening. On the Docket airs every Sunday at 4:30 on Long Island News 103.9. So until next Sunday, this is Patricia Salkin, Dean of Touro Law Center. Have a great weekend.